Yes, thank you very much. So I'm working with Gregor Weiss, you may all know. So he is on vacation, so I have the honor to give you a talk about our experiment, what we have done on the measurements of higher order interferences. So first, the motivation. So I don't have to give a deep motivation for you. So quantum mechanics is based on axioms, as you all know. So the question is, are they correct? The good thing about physics is you can make some experiments and test them experimentally. There's still this incompatibility between the quantum mechanics and gravitation, so they cannot be unified at the moment. But there are some theories that there is a need for generalization of one of these theories for unifications, and for this generalization, axioms could be violated. And our test is the test for higher order interferences. So I will now explain you now the how the higher order interferences are defined. So you all may know it. Just a brief reminder. So we start with Born's rule, which is just the probability measurement. So if you want to know the probability of a wave function, you just take the absolute square. So as in a simple example, in a Mach-Zehnder interferometer where you have two possible passes, pass A and pass B, there's this superposition of these two passes. So either it goes through pass A or it goes through pass B. And when you now want to get the probability of this wave function, you just apply this Born's rule here. Then what you get is you have first the square root of psi A plus the square root of psi B, and then you have a mixed term. So you now can identify those terms, so that psi A squared is the probability of taking pass A, psi B is the probability taking pass B, and this mixed term is this so-called interference term of the first order. And it's generally non-zero, so it depends basically on the phase differences of these two arms. So if you now expand this to three passes, you get a similar situation. So you can make same calculations. And what you find, you get always this single pass probabilities and these interference terms, which have the pairs of the passes. So we can now reformulate this a bit. So you can use the previous definitions for the interference terms. And that's what you get. But what you see, there's no term where all these three wave functions occur. And so this interference term should be zero, according to this theory. And that's what we want to measure. So how is this done in the experiment? So we say, so it's not easy to measure some probabilities directly. And then we say that the probabilities are proportional to intensities on a photodetector or count rates on a click detector. You also have to take single photons into account. And then we get this expression, which is defined as epsilon, which is proportional to the IABC term. And this should be zero. So we can measure this in, for example, in multipass interferometers by blocking and unblocking different passes. So if you want to measure EABC, you just open three passes. If you want to measure BAB, you close pass C and let the others open, and so on. And so we have eight different possible combinations for this situation. And of course, it's not easy to compare these epsilon values with each other. So you need some normalization. And the normalization is usually taken as the ratio of the of this epsilon divided by the sum of the two pass interference terms. So there were already some previous realizations. The first one was done by Ubushi Sina here in Waterloo some years ago. They used different sources. Sort of first source was a single photon source where they used a laser which pumped a nonlinear PPKTP crystal. Here we have spontaneous spirometric down conversion, and then we get pairs of out of this crystal. Or it was also used an attenuant laser source. To realize these different interference terms, a slit mask was used. So all these different possible combinations were realized on this slit mask, and this slit mask was moved through this path to get these interferences. So the results so the kappa results were in the order of 10 to the minus 3. So here no violation was observed, so these values, so the error was still larger than the error. So then the next step was to make this in an interferometer, here in a Michelson configuration. So here a laser was employed, then grating split up the beam into three beams. Then here a mirror reflects these beams back, and it was again overlapped on this grating and then detected. Here in this work, a similar kappa value was found. It was also in the order of 10 to the minus 3. And there were also some other experiments. So one was realized with a spatial light modulator, and this different interference terms were realized in orbital angular momentum, and also in a nuclear magnetic resonance on a 3-qubit molecule that was also performed here in Waterloo. And as you see, those kappa values are all in the same order of magnitude. So we now have improved this interferometric setup, which I will present you now. So we have also the possibility to employ two different sources. So for either we'll use a laser at 8 to 8 nanometers, or we use again a single photon source. We will again use a PPKTP crystal. This produces photon pairs. These photon pairs have orthogonal polarization, so we can easily split them up on a polarizing beam splitter. So one goes to a Hurling detector, and the other one is sent to our interferometer. So our interferometer consists of first of a diffractive beam splitter. So this here, the incoming light is split up into 5 outgoing beams. Then we have a lens to collimate those 5 beams. Then a second lens to overlap the beams on the second grating. Then we also have a shutter assembly, which you can see here. Here the beams can go through, or not, depending on the how these motors are set. So you see here the dimensions of our setup. So the distances between our holes are around 5 millimeters. The hole interferometer is about 60 centimeters long, and we also have face plates to set fixed faces. Also, this interferometer is face stabilized, so we first of all we put a box around it to prevent it against air movement and air drift, and it's also actively temperature stabilized to about 10s of microkelvin. So this makes it quite phase stable, and so as we have now 5 beams, we have now not 8 different combinations which have to be measured, but 32. And you might ask now,
why did you have 2 lasers?
So we can choose between those two. So either we use the laser, or we use the single photons. So for the experiment we only take one at each experiment. So not both at the same time. So that we have different experimental regimes which we can measure. So first of all is classical with a classic laser and a photoreceiver, then semi-classical where you use the single photon sources but unheralded, and then in the quantum regime where we have the heralded single photon. So which means we only take events where we get here a click and of course here.
Yeah. What is the unheralded one, semi-classical?
So because we have here a parametric down conversion source, mm-hmm. which doesn't produce really single photon states or single photons, mm-hmm. you have still the probability that there are more than one photon is mm-hmm. in the interferometer at the same time.
So you're talking about the higher order states, like twos and
this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then that, so okay, because you're not heralding, you're saying you don't know, and that's why you're putting.
Mm-hmm.
But then the laser also, it's not really classical, is it? It's a coherent state.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say it's a purely classical source. No, because that's always a question. But then
yeah.
because you've said it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a clarification.
Yeah.
Does that mean that when it's unheralded, you really just have a Poissonian distribution
yeah.
with the mean
mm.
that's down near 0
mm.
or 1?
Mm. Yeah.
That's the idea.
Mm. Yeah.
When it is heralded, what's the rate of two photons? Because there'll be, you know, mostly one photon, but you're going to have some probability of higher numbers. So what's...
Yeah, so our single photon source produces about 500 single photons per second, and the pair rate is about 20% of this, so we have so around 100,000 pairs per second. But of course, that's measured directly here after the beam splitter. Of course, you have losses through the interferometer, and depending on also on this. Settings in the of the shutters, you also get some losses, and you have at maximum you have about the transmission of about 20% through the interferometer.
So you say it's a Poisson distribution in the unheralded case, but isn't it a thermal distribution instead? Because it's aren't you creating an EPR state? Using the parametric non-converter and then tracing out on one of the arms. What's the process to create the single photon? It's not pumping a nonlinear crystal here.
Yeah.
So you create rank two beams, two entangled beams, and in one case you can detect a photon in one beam and say there's one in the other. That's the heralding.
Yeah, so basically it's not entangled, it's just heralded, so
yeah. And then if you don't post select, you have a thermal state, so it's not a Poisson state, Poisson distribution, I would say.
Yeah.
The coherent state, indeed, it's a Poisson distribution.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, so maybe I understood your question.
So it's not a coherent state?
Yeah. No.
It's a coherent state in the case of the laser.
Yeah. It's in the case of the laser, it's a coherent state. Mm-hmm.
About the semi-classic, the middle one.
Yeah.
The semi-classic one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a thermal distribution.
It's a thermal distribution.
The last one is sub-Poisson. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's what makes it different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessary. It's not entangled. So.
No. Yeah. That's what I said. Yeah. It's not entangled.
Okay.
It's entangled in energy and momentum. That's always the case. But not in polarization.
Yeah.
You're not using that.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But are you not throwing away one of the?
In the second case, he's just throwing away one.
Yeah.
Of the
so we just with ignoring this photon and just taking one. It's an including interferometer.
So it's a thermal state with a very low temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's worth commenting. That sum rule doesn't depend on being a pure state. It's also valid for mixed states.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, so you might ask now why we're taking more than three passes. Because if we talk previously only a free. So one is an experimental reason, so we have more statistics. So we have in a five-pass interferometer, we have four-pass interferometers and 10 three-pass interferometers, so we can get more data for the kappa 3 and kappa 4. Then of course we are able to measure this fourth and five pass terms directly, and then we can probably say something about Born's rule modifications. So for example, this is some series about power series or modified exponent, and also it's possible to test some explicit models. So for example, this nonlinear extension of Born's rule, which we see here, or this density cube model, where we have a density cube instead of a density matrix to describe a quantum state. So what we have now done, we have repeated our measurement several times. So here for the classical case, around 5,000 times. Well, here we have taken the different combinations in random order. So here you see when we have all the passes closed, so this is just a dark current of the detector and background. Then here we have one pass open, you see here pass A open, and the other closed, pass B, C, D, and E. And of course, we did it for all the other possible combinations for two passes open, three passes, four and five. Yeah?
So, what is the y axis? Signal.
That's
so
the signal in voltage.
So, they're not equivalent, right? The five parts.
So you see that, sorry. There's this beam splitter is not exactly producing equal intensities in all the five passes. And then you see that there's a bit of difference.
And so you account for that, normalize for that later on?
Yeah. So basically you normalize it in with this kappa definition, then it doesn't play around much.
What is the contribution from those parts which are not in the five? So the higher order as you call them?
Yeah, so we block them out. So.
Right. But then they are there in principle. So then the total is, sum of the five is not one. That's not the only thing. So then is ignoring them introducing some subtlety in this observation, in this experiment?
I don't think so, but it's just an additional loss through your interferometer. Because you also do not care about the other outputs of your interferometer, because you only have one output which is shown here, but you also have some outputs which are going this way or this way. So actually having seven outputs here after the second grating, and you're also ignoring them.
So you're not measuring their entire intensity? You have all five open.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then what you're going to measure after the second grating? So you're ignoring six contributions there?
Yeah, so if you send your beam through a beam splitter, you get always these five beams.
Sure.
And if you're coming from different angles, you also get in total seven.
But what you measure in the end should have all five.
Yeah, so we're only taking the middle one because
You see that the middle one you are just converging and measuring.
Yeah.
The others are going, okay.
Because the middle one is the only one which contains all the
information for the five.
And so we also have here additional losses in these measured outputs of the interferometer.
Because in these experiments, this is a common this thing which comes, that criticism, that are things that you're not measuring somehow conniving with each other and giving your conspiracy theory, which does exactly the opposite of what you're claiming. It's there in all of these quantum optics experiments, right? Then you have to be sure of what you're ignoring and that the subdominant in the state, that they won't really conspire and do something completely opposite. So you have you probably still measure a zero, which you will come to. But these perhaps give a non-zero, then what happens? So that can lead to a lot of interesting many discussions. But what you're saying is that those are small enough that ignoring them does not lead to any such philosophical thoughts.
Yeah, I can't say that.
You don't want to say that.
I don't know to say that there could be some
discussion.
Sorry, just to get this discussion.
Does it mean that from this P1, P2, P3, P4, P5 of single slip probabilities, we basically measure only P3 and then say this would be the same as the other?
No. So that what you have in the experiment, you're coming on the different angles to your second grating, and each of this beam creates another five of those
ones.
And only in this middle one you have an overlap of all the five ones because of the geometry. And this middle one contains all the five contains all the five passes here. And of course, it's only a portion of what's going from here to here, because it's again split up into five.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah. And that's what you see here. So yeah, that's this little output of the interferometer. So if you remind a simple Mach-Zehnder interferometer, you also have two outputs.
Right.
And in the previous slides, I also looked at one of the two outputs.
Yeah. Great, makes sense.
Yeah. And of course, you have here, of course, a higher signal due to constructive interference in the two and higher pass terms. Yeah, and you also see the stability of our source. So it's quite our laser was intensity stabilized. And now if you compare this with the semi-classical, where we take this.
So you say event number times 1,000. So is it, do you record the intensity continuously here, or is it?
No. At each point or one measurement set that contains of 32 different combinations in our interferometer, so it's open and closed. And we make this in random order to reduce the effects of drifts and so on.
But how many counts are there in one event? One path configuration.
Yeah, so that's with the laser. So you see here the signal in volt.
Yes.
So that's just in a.
So do you have an idea of the number of counts of clicks?
You just have a laser. You should send it on a photo detector.
Yes. How many photons?
Some huge
number. So it's a few microwatts of laser light. Right. So. You can calculate it. So
10 to the 16.
Yeah, something in this order. Yeah.
Okay. That's huge.
That's huge, yeah.
So the number of experiments here is really big.
So 10 to 16. Yeah, so. Yeah, and then compared to the semi classical, when we take the single photons, you see here the count rates in kilohertz, so counts per second. We again have the different combinations, and so at the maximum for the five paths we have around 135,000 events per second or photons which are going through the interferometer. And you see here again, so we have a broader distribution on one hand, and on the other hand you see there's a bit of drift, so that's mainly due to the fact that the pump laser of our down conversion source was not intensity stabilized, and so you see these drifts here.
Are there 10
the three paths open, that means roughly, does it mean 10 different?
Yeah. So you, that should, there should be, sorry, here should be 10 different colors, identifying 10 different sub-combinations in the three pass open case.
It's hard to resolve.
Yeah, it's hard to resolve. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, somewhere there's a 10. Yeah. And they are also overlapping. So the intensity are quite similar. So you have here, so here 5 different colors or 5 different combinations. And here again 10 different 2-pass combinations and 4-pass combinations.
And why is it that the closed case is now much larger relatively to the signal of the other path configurations? So in the classical case, it was 10 to minus 5 compared to 40, and here it's...
So here we have the click detector, and this click detector at around this 150 dark counts per second. Mm-hmm. Of course, we could buy a better one, which would be more expensive.
So but usually... It's not the same detector as...
No. Before, it was just a classical photo receiver, so just a photodiode. Mm-hmm. And here it was a single photon detector. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now we can take or calculate kappa for each of these measurement sets, which we have done here. So we have made calculated this kappa and put it in the histogram, and this is for a three-pass case, for the combination ABC. And then we can take the mean and the standard error of the mean of this case. And of course, there are, we have to take all the different sub-interferometers into account. So we have all the 10 sub-3-pass interferometers, and from this we can then calculate this mean value.
Some of them are non-zero, right?
Yeah, so we have now done this for these different measurement cases of classical, semi-classical, and quantum, and we have then calculated this kappa 3, so for only the 3 passes, the kappa 4 for the 4-pass interferometers, and the kappa 5 for the 5-pass interferometers. And as you already saw, they are here non-zero, especially for the classical case, and not even within the one standard deviation. So now we can look at our interferometer and think about the errors which can occur. So there are random errors, for example, counter-rate fluctuations, detector and electronic noise, and phase fluctuations. So these all are averaged out when you make many measurements. So that's the reason why we have done these 5,000 measurements. But it just changes you the distribution. So the histogram would get broader if the errors are greater. So then there's another error, the non-perfect coherence, which means that beams are not perfectly overlapped on the second beam splitter. This gives no error, but what gives you an error are the systematic errors. So these non-classical passes and the detector nonlinearity and the dead time of our single photon detectors. So the non-classical passes, you will, I guess, hear a talk about it later in this workshop. These are just these come from this Feynman pass integral formulation. So that the light cannot only go straight through the slit or the shutter. It can only take those non-classical passes. In our case, it's not negligible. So we calculated and I think it's in the order of 10 to the minus 8.
A few millimeters apart, aren't you?
Yeah. So because of these dimensions, it doesn't make much of an effect, so it's several orders of magnitude smaller than what we have measured. But the details will come in a different talk. But yeah, so here it's some, here's the formula where we some where we can
in the
far field you can average this or sorry estimate this with this formula, and you see it's in 10 to the minus 7, so much smaller than what we get. But what we found out is that the dectron linearity is the main source of error. So if you now think of an idle detector, you send some physical signal on the detector, so basically the amount of light or the number of photons, and then you record it. So you, for example, record some voltage or some count rate. And usually would for an idle detector, which we would expect some linear behavior. So if you put twice the signal, you would expect that you get twice the voltage. But of course, or unfortunately, that's not the case for real detectors. They have always some non-linearity. So this response curve can now vary for different intensities on the detector. So different terms get a different bias. So here for small light, for example, or for small amount of signal, you have a small error. And for larger or for more light, you get the larger error here. And of course, this affects this epsilon value because you're adding different intensities. So what we have now done is we have now characterized our detectors for nonlinearity. We have done this with this superposition method. So we have taken two lasers, overlapped them on a beam splitter, and then we have measured this residual signal. So we've first measured the intensity of one light or from one laser source, and then the intensity of the second laser source, and then combined for both. That's this residual signal. So that should be zero for an idle detector. And we also have measured this for different input intensities. And for example, for our photoreceiver, so for classical light, we get such a curve. You see here at zero we have small error, and as we go to the higher intensities, we get a deviation. So this deviation is not large, it's only some 38 ppm. And what we also found out, it's not the main source of error, is the photo receiver itself. It's the voltmeter, or the AD converter, which converts the signal to a digital signal, which can be recorded by a computer. And of course, we have done the same measurement for a single photon detector. And here the main source of error is the dead time of the single photon detector, which means so a photon comes to the detector, then an electrical pulse is created, then it takes some time to recharge, and during this time the detector is blind. So if there's coming a second photon, then it won't be detected, and so it's lost. And that's what you see here. So the higher the input signal, the more photons are lost there. And from this, we can now estimate you see here there's already almost 1% difference. And from this, we can estimate now our dead time of our detector. So it's around 34 nanoseconds. And now we have to make some state tomography, so we have to reconstruct our state, which is in our interferometer. So this was done with via a numerical reconstruction, which comes from 46 different single and two pass measurements with different phases in our interferometer. Then we can reconstruct some density matrix here, so it's a five-dimensional Q-state state. And from this state tomography and the nonlinearity values, we can now calculate our predicted values. So what you see here, so in orange, that's what we measured previously, and this blue lines are these predicted values from the tomography and the nonlinearity measurements. And you see there are some differences here in these measurements and the predicted values. So it's only in the percent range, but you can now calculate the kappa theoretical from this predicted data and compare these results. So we take the difference between the measured values and the predicted values, and that should be ideally zero, and that's what we get here. So we see here we've got almost perfect zero. So all these points lie within the one standard deviation of zero. But what you also may see is that this, especially for the classical case, the errors get a bit bigger, and that's due to the uncertainty in the nonlinearity measurement. So as to sum up these results, so in this experiment we have not found higher order interference, but only an upper bound, so it's an improvement of two orders of magnitude, as you have seen here. So we have here 10 to the minus 5 for the classical case, and for the semi-classical we have 10 to the minus 4, and it's the first measurements of kappa 4 and 5. And our main sources of error are these nonlinearities and the counting errors in our single photon case. So now in the next step, we want to improve our setup. So there's another concept of the multipath interferometer where we want to make it on one hand smaller. So as I said, it's this three path interferometer is around 60 centimeters. So we can achieve even a better stability if it's smaller. Then for other measurement, we need perfect mode overlap. So that's required for the Paris test against hypercomplex quantum mechanics. And for all these reasons, we choose the integrated optical setup as an option. So I will shortly introduce you how integrated optics works. So basically, everything is on a glass chip. So what was done, so it's in a collaboration with the University of Vienna. We take a femtosecond laser, focus it onto this glass chip, and move it. What happens there is that usually in this glass you have some silicon oxide nine ring structure. Due to this high power laser power, this gets changed, or this changes to a three ring structure. This has the effect that this also the refractive index changes a little bit. So it's in the order of 10 to the minus 4. But due to this small difference in refractive index, light can be coupled into these modes, in these spatial modes. So the light is caught in there due to total internal reflection, like in a fiber. It's also possible to make some kind of beam splitters in there. So that's realized to evanescent coupling between the waveguides. So what you do, you bring those waveguides near to each other, so you make the distance between them smaller. Then there's this optical tunneling possible, so light can tunnel from this middle waveguide through these outer waveguides. And depending on the length and the coupling, you can now realize different beam splitters. So for example, you can make a one-third beam splitter. And now we want to realize an interferometer. So we have here this beam splitter, put here mirrors at the output, and send then the light back and couple it out. So that's similar to this setup, which was realized here in free space. So now how will the shutters be realized? So basically what we do, if you have the on state, so the mirror is close to the to the glass surface, so almost all of the light gets reflected. And if we move now this mirror a little bit away, then this light can diverge, and not all of the light can be coupled back into the waveguide again. So you see here that if you increase the distance already a few millimeters, you have a factor of 100 which gets lost. So how does this look now? So here you have this waveguide chip, and here you have the three different individual movable mirrors. So they are pulled with servo motors forth and back. And what we have again made this same measurements as before, so for the different combinations, so one pass open, two pass open, and three pass open. And what you see, especially in the two and three pass open, you have here a big distribution, a wide distribution of the intensities. And that's due to the fact that this mirrors do not go back to the exactly same position every time, and then you have a different phase in your interferometer. So only a few tenths of nanometer change already the phase a bit, and so this is current problem. So but we tried to again calculate these kappas from these results, from these measurements, and you see we are not so good at the moment. So it's 10 to the minus 2. So
what is your experience?
So
what do you mean by it's not good?
So yeah, so compared to previous results, where we have 10 to the minus 5.
What is your error threshold for this thing?
Sorry?
What is your calculated error threshold for this version of the experiment? Is it much larger than 10? I mean, in the sense that, are you sure this is a zero?
Yeah, you see the error is much larger than the
That's
value itself.
It's the same order.
It's the same order, yeah. So yeah, we are trying now to improve this setup a bit. So as I said, its phase repeatability and also the measurement time is very long, and the efficiency is not so good. So that's the work in progress at the moment. So we're realizing a Mach Zehnder interferometer type on the glass waveguide. So we are realizing these beam splitters at the beginning, at the end of the glass chip. And in the middle, we have here three holes where we can move small, thin wires, really only 50 micrometers thick, up and down to block and unblock the passes. So that's the current status. So we don't have any results at the moment, so it's just ongoing. Do you have a question?
You have the possibility of reflection from the shutter, which
yeah.
Go all the way back up into the fiber optic of the waveguide and add intensity to the open beams by virtue of closing one.
Mm.
So other than when you don't introduce the gap of one way back, what do you do to the shutter to reduce reflection? Do you use like some highly absorptive?
So you mean in here in this case, or
yeah.
So if you say the mirror is say 2 millimeters away,
I'm saying not the case. I'm saying when you did your kappa 5 kappa 4 experiment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you just had regular old shutters.
Yeah. Yeah.
The shutters were made of metal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's. Did you try to experimentally reduce reflection?
Yeah. So we made them
anti-reflection.
Yeah, actually it was some kind of metal, so we made it black. So yeah, I don't know how it's exactly called, but we just put it in some solvent to make it black. And so that reduces almost all the back reflections. So we have this. Yeah, so now we'll come to the end of my talk, give a short summary. So as I said, in our free space experiment, we have on the upper bound for higher order interference terms, including detailed analysis of our experimental errors. As I said, we have an improvement of several orders of magnitude compared to previous measurements. And at the moment, we're working on new designs on switchable integrated, oh, sorry for the typo, optical multipath interferometers. So here is our work group, or the group of Gregor Weiss in Innsbruck. So these people are working on the experiment. So we have collaboration with Vienna, with Charles Bruckner, he gives some theoretical input, and of course of Jena, who are producing these waveguide chips, and of course with some funding. And here are the references. And thank you for your attention. Yeah?
So I was curious, I think when I heard all the talks by Gregor, there was the idea to do this Paris experiment right away, maybe with that setup, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that also the reason why you had five pads?
Yes.
And did you try this?
Yeah, so I actually have some slides here. Maybe already here. Yeah, so for all of, I don't know how familiar with this Paris thing. So basically, it's a test if you have in quantum mechanics complex numbers like this or higher numbers. So, for example, these quaternions or even higher. And you, what the idea behind this test, you have three scatterers, or in the interferometric case, three different passes where you can measure these phases, and you then can calculate this F value, where you have this, for geometrical reasons, we have these conditions. F should be should be 1 for complex quantum theory, and if it's between 0 and 1, then you have quaternionic quantum theory. And if it's greater than 1, you have this superposition principle violated. And so we have measured or tried to measure it, and what we see, we have values much below 1. And the reason is why is the following, because in this theory only pure states, or this theory is only applicable for pure state, which means you need perfect overlap or on your second beam splitter. And that's also the reason why I'm going to the integrated optics version to measure this Paris test. And for this free space experiment, we don't have applicable results.
Have you like talked to Czaslav as well about generalizing it to mixtures? Where it's you just generalize a theorem first and then measure it?
Yeah, yeah. So we are at the moment, we actually have some project together, and it already started only recently, and so we're working on this.
Okay.
So on the one hand, to make a new theory for measuring this, even with imperfect states, or imperfect or not pure states, and on the other hand, we are going to experimentally realize this on these waveguides where we have perfect overlap.
So I was wondering if you've given any thought to ways of analyzing the systematic errors that would be a more direct test of higher order interference, so without going through the assumption that quantum theory is valid. Mm-hmm. So if I understood your analysis correctly, you say here's the theoretical prediction for the errors under the assumption that quantum theory is valid, and here's our experimental data, we take the difference.
Yeah.
But of course, if quantum theory is not valid, then maybe those theoretical bars would be different. So maybe experiments trying to tell you there's hard order interference, but you're not giving it the chance because you're doing your error analysis in a way that presumes quantum theory. So I wonder if there might be another way of doing the error analysis wouldn't presume quantum theory.
Yeah.
So I have a comment on that. So what you're trying to say is that we should have a theoretical bound. from superquantum theory kind of thing, then maybe the experiment on that will match better. So, but what he is doing is he's doing an error analysis which is regardless of quantum, right? It's an error analysis of the experiment. So those experimental errors, they are giving him whatever confidence level that you are getting in. So there is no, so then, I mean, you know, you can put, so quantum theory gives a certain prediction, and then you can come up with a model which is not quantum, and that will change that prediction, and that might match the error corrected version of his experiment. But his error correction itself won't change.
So I guess
no bias.
Let me ask to see if that's really the case. So when you you're saying it's the nonlinear in the detector, which is really the key thing. In going to the sort of theoretical predictions from your experimentally measured nonlinearities, have you used quantum assumptions in that inference?
For the nonlinearity measurements, I think there are no quantum assumptions. But of course, if you do the state tomography and reconstruction and the prediction, you of course need some quantum theory.
Right.
And of course, I know that there is some problem in this.
So if it's just the state tomography, maybe all you need to do is do a generalized probabilistic theory version of state tomography. And then get your theoretical estimates from that GPT framework, and then at no step have you appealed to quantum theory.
I was confused on that too. Can you say a little more? I had a similar question to you.
Yeah.
Not as sharp, but what exactly did you? I didn't understand exactly what you did when you talked about the state tomography.
Yeah. So.
Why did you need to do that in order to?
Yeah, so for you need
to quantify the errors. Or...
Yeah, so on one hand you need just a second. So we get from tomography we get this density matrix. And from this density matrix and the nonlinearity, we can now calculate these predicted values. Was this your question, or what was the question about?
I'm just not quite grasping it somehow. I mean, you might think that the nonlinearity is just something like Rob was saying. It's just a property of the detectors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why do you have to reconstruct the state? Why can't you just correct the reading of the detector to say that this represents, it looked like it was 5 counts per second, but it was really only 4.3 counts per second or something. Why do you need to go back and do this tomography in order to in order to correct the detectors.
Yeah, so basically what you...
when you say tomography, what is the state exactly? It's the state of what that you're doing tomography on?
Basically, you can say in your interferometer you have these possibilities of being 5 passes, or if you have a single photon, you have this superposition.
Yeah.
So to say to in this... of these 5 passes, so you have this 5-dimensional Q-dit state.
So that's the state you're reconstructing?
Yeah, that's the state we are reconstructing. And that's what you get from in this density matrix.
Is that critical to do because of what you showed us at the very beginning, that the responses on the different beams are different? Like, is that why the state tomography is important?
Yeah.
So if the responses were more uniform across the 5 beams, you might be able to forego state tomography? Or not?
I don't know.
In the end, it's just one detector and a single beam, isn't it? I mean, in the end, you combine the 5 beams into one, and you only put the detector in that one beam. So why isn't it enough to just know the true response function of that detector? Recalibrate it according to... It's dead time. The problem is dead time.
Yeah, the dead time and the deck door non-linearity. This is the main problem.
If you want to define grid,
does it depend which beam it came from somehow? Did the detector react differently depending which of the five beams the photon?
No. It depends only on the count rate itself, on the intensity.
So you have actually measured the actual counts when you constructed the state.
And
then you've measured the nonlinearity. And then you've said that how the nonlinearity can, factored in the nonlinearity and then found what the state would have been without the nonlinearity. So that's why you have to measure the state with nonlinearity and measure nonlinearity separately. And then account for that and then come up with the true kappa. Which is independent of this error.
Yeah.
So that's why you did the tomography. Right?
Yeah.
So okay.
Well, the question is, somehow it's, I'm not taking it in right, but the question is whether there's another way of doing it without the tomography. So.
Okay.
There's less dependent on various theoretical assumptions.
Yes.
Because the sum rule itself doesn't rely on these assumptions.
So let's say, for instance, you focus on the results on the single pass and two path, like you do here from the but then you predict what would be the signal for a three path term, knowing that you have some nonlinearity in the detector. This must be doable because the linearity only depends on the intensity of the signal, in a sense. So it's a correction on the intensity of the signal. So you could calculate the intensity of the signal, knowing what is kappa 1 and kappa 2 for the all configurations, and then, correct for the kappa 3 theoretical. Correct for the kappa 3, you could predict with the sums of these kappa 1s and kappa 2s by the linearity without any tomography. No. Isn't it possible?
By only mesh.
Oh, something escapes me. What is the effect of the nonlinearity? If you know what is the intensity you expect, you predict a correction due to the nonlinearity of the detector.
Well, if you can predict, you don't need tomography. I think the tomography is not absolutely essential. You can just move the tomography, just find out what are those 32 values, what they are, and then of course you have the nonlinearity measurement, so you can predict what would be the nonlinear kappa, kappa due to that, and then you can avoid the tomography altogether.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're
saying. Yes.
Yeah.
Because tomography has an implicit assumption of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, yes, of course, that's, again,
because here, I guess it's a max type of construction, so you assume rho is positive, you assume rho exists.
Yeah.
So it's a Gregorian one, so that's a lot of additional assumptions.
And then you use the Horn rule, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Probabilities from the density.
Yeah, yeah. Then we have to think also about this in the future. How to circumvent this?
When you were calculating a nonlinearity, you could tune the strength of any single beam. You don't trust that is a linear attenuator. Is that why you're using two beams? Or can you trust that, as you dial that, that's quite definitely linear,
so
and scale against it.
The main reason why we're taking two beams is because we don't want, or two independent sources, because we don't want interference between the two beams. Because when we only take one, there's always only one source. There's only a possibility that there's interference. But when you're thinking about the attenuators, in our case, it was some polarizer, because we have polarized laser light, which was rotated. So it's basically not, so we try to make it as linear as possible, but it's basically not not necessary to have a linear distribution of the different intensities because of because we're only interested in this residual signal, which is basically the differences between the intensities. And what we then plot is basically this residual signal depending on the total signals on the I12. Mm-hmm. And as you see here, you have many, many data points here, several thousands again. And then we do some data fitting. And for this, you don't actually need some really very strict linear distribution.
Yeah. I wonder the motivation for redoing the experiment with integrated optics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that because, in principle, you could get better bounds, that you expect the errors, that the noise to go down? And
yeah, that was one of the reasons to go for. To make it smaller and compact, more compact, to get even lower bounds.
So if the new scenario with the wires works out, do you anticipate going from 10 to the minus 5 down to one order of magnitude, two orders of magnitude? What do you expect to happen then?
So it's hard to say, but
yeah.
Hopefully, well, at least one order of magnitude. Depends also, so you also need some. So as I said, so the distribution, how the points are distributed, depends also on the stability of your source, on the phase fluctuations, which we expect should be much better in if the setup is much smaller, and so on. Yeah.
And are the detectors just as good?
Sorry?
Are the detectors just as good?
Yeah, so for this photoreceiver or for this photodetector, these 38 ppm are already very good. So the problem is that if you buy a detector, the linearity or non-linearity is always the least important property or the producers are usually not very interested in the linearity of the detectors. They're only interested in efficiency, noise, and so on. And so that's also the reason why we have to characterize it ourselves. They only say it's, if you're lucky, they say it has good non-linearity.
I'm guessing attenuators,
yeah.
I'm guessing people who make attenuators care more about linearity.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if you used an attenuator that was well characterized,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe the signal on the detector are always about the same size, maybe
you could increase your anyway. Mm. So you would need then different attenuations for different path settings, I mean.
But those presumably are designed to be very.
Okay, yeah, so I don't know, so we have to look into that.
So I'm a bit concerned by the classical case, so I'm wondering if what does it change to have a coherent state compared to a single photon? And so in the coherent state case, you have, you cannot write what happens as a five possible alternative. There are much more. Because you can have one photon in one path and two photons in the other, and etc. So you have actually a lot of more alternatives. So,
yeah.
So is it is it the same test? I wonder. can you comment on the differences between
quantum? As you said, so you have classical light. You have not such a superposition, as I will call it. It's just some. Distribution of different beams. So basically, I would say more fundamental question. It's more an electrodynamical problem than a quantum problem. So if you have basically a similar rule in electrodynamics than one rule here in quantum mechanics, so this square root of the electrical field gives you some, basically the intensity. And here we go, if we would have here a violation, we have even we would have this violation in this electrodynamical case.
But it would have second order.
Yeah.
It would be like classical waves.
Yeah. There's also a recent paper where which connects also these two cases. I can look it up and give you the reference.
Have you compared the Paris measurements with the predictions by the tomography?
No.
Okay.
Just a small comment on terminology. When you talked about the non-classical paths as a possible, and then you showed that their contribution was negligible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I would call them non-classical paths because, I mean, they are non-classical paths, but there are other non-classical paths as well, which are being included, if you see what I mean. And classical paths suggests that you only want straight line paths, whereas the paths that you're excluding, they're like there, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The green path you're including,
yeah.
The green path could be arbitrarily wiggly, just mm-hmm. so it doesn't go through a second slit. So I'm not sure what the right...
Maybe you could
experiment. Of course, yeah. So the non-classical path, and we've defined it rather clearly just for this question. In the paper as
so
well.
It has a special meaning.
It has a special meaning.
Yeah, so I think you also you had the problem with the
yes,
terminology.
With the terminology and the referees and so on.
I see.
And so
I wasn't
in, conflict of interest.
So I was only using your
I know. Yeah. So the non-classical path is a path which is crossing the slip plane more than once.
I see.
And it is a classical, it's not the classically dominant path. So
right.
It does not extremize the action. And so it's not a quantum path. So non-classical does not mean quantum.
Right.
It's just not the classically dominant, and so it's a sublinear contribution. So, I mean, which of course I'll tell again tomorrow. But yeah, he was just using the terminology.
So I should blame you.
Yes. But it's, I don't think the blame because we have defined it.
Yes.
Very well.
Yeah, one can.
Should we go for lunch? Okay, let's go.